When it comes to maximizing time in the uplands, without fail, Onyx Hunt is my most valuable tool. From planning my next hunt through a new bird cover to navigating in the field, Onyx Hunt is truly with me wherever I go. With detailed mapping and satellite imagery, along with a multitude of map layers from land access to forestry and habitat information, and easy-to-use tools to mark, measure, and catalog important information, Onyx Hunt seamlessly integrates digital scouting with boots-on-the-ground time in the field. With offline mapping and Apple CarPlay integration, you are free to explore the wild landscapes our beloved upland birds inhabit. Planning your next move in the uplands begins with knowing where you stand, and for me, that starts and stops with Onyx Hunt. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and use the promo code BSP20 to save 20% on your Onyx Hunt subscription. When the miles rack up faster than your flush count, that's when you'll truly appreciate your hunting vest from Final Rise. Built for the uplands and proudly sewn in the USA, the complete lineup of hunting vests from Final Rise, from their all-new Summit XT down to the minimalist Sidekick system, are all built upon the foundational load-bearing waist belt and low-profile shoulder strap system, which allow you to carry all the gear you need and do so comfortably while maintaining your ability to move freely and perform when you need to most. With a complete lineup of accessories and newly released performance field apparel, Final Rise has the gear you need to help you get the most out of every mile and every flush. Final Rise gear is built for the uplands. Get yours today at finalrise.com. This episode of the Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt, the number one GPS hunting app, and Final Rise, premium quality, made in USA hunting vests and field apparel, and Upland Gun Company, custom built and fit, handcrafted Italian shotguns. Hey everybody, welcome to episode number 269 of the Birdshot Podcast. Thanks for joining us as always. We've got a good friend of the show, part-time grouse hunting guide and coordinator of an upcoming Upland Gun Company event. Joining us on the show today, Jim Gerchy. We'll be talking bird dogs, grouse hunting, shotguns, and more. We'll talk to Jim in just a minute. A quick thank you to Patreon patrons of the Birdshot Podcast. I'll be out there making those contributions in support of the show to keep these episodes coming your way. I appreciate you, and I thank you. Patrons are eligible for Patreon giveaways, bonus content, and the Birdshot Podcast canned coolers and stickers. You can learn more and sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. If you love the show and you're looking for more ways to contribute, you can always leave the podcast a rating, review, subscribe to the show, follow the show, whatever you can do in your podcast app or player. Share an episode, tell a friend something cool you heard on the show from one of our guests. Every little bit helps, and I appreciate that as well. All right, I'm back from my trip to the Gulf, Florida, and I will not bore you with the details, but I just wanted to say thank you to a number of the listeners of the show that were from the area or knew the area and reached out to me with some excellent recommendations for things to do, things to see, places to eat. My family and I had an amazing trip down to Destin, Florida, and it is awesome to know that there are listeners of the Birdshot Podcast all over the place, and your recommendations were greatly appreciated. So thanks for that. My son even got to reel in a pompano from the beach. The surf fishing was recommended to me by a couple of listeners that it was pretty good timing for that down there, and we did not get a guide or do anything on our own, but there were people fishing on the beach every day, and my son and I got to know somebody that was staying at the same place we were, and of course I was chatting him up about what he was using and the tackle and gear, and it was kind of slow actually while we were there. There weren't a ton of fish caught, but when you know it, we were standing there next to him and my son and I saw his rod going off, so we got to hurry over there, and he graciously let my son reel in a pretty nice pompano. So that was kind of a cherry on top of a great, great trip. So once again, thanks to listeners out there. I really appreciate it. And moving on to our show today. During the show, you will hear Jim and I talk about, towards the end, an upcoming event presented by Upland Gun Company that we are very excited about. And we'll hopefully see some of you out there listening at this event. It will be the Midwest Double Gun Classic presented by Upland Gun Company at the Horse and Hunt Club in Prior Lake, Minnesota. Date of the shoot is June 8th. Saturday, June 8th will be the main event. Upland Gun Company, myself, will be there much of the week ahead of the shoot doing scheduled gun fittings, which we already have on the books. And Horse and Hunt usually has entertainment music going on Friday nights, I think. So Friday night will be a cool hangout time at the Horse and Hunt if you're in town for the shoot or nearby. And then Saturday, the main event will be ongoing. There's the main shoot that you can register for now. There will be a link in the show notes with some additional details on this. And there will also be side events and other things going on during the shoot. So wanted to mention it here. It would be a good place to come down and get a look at some of the RFM shotguns from Upland Gun Company if you were wanting to do that. The Horse and Hunt Club is a great place to come on down and practice your shotgunning skills. They've got multiple sporting clays courses, and like I said, you've got the main event and some side events, and just be a whole lot of stuff going on that weekend at the Horse and Hunt Club. So you're hearing about it here first on the Birdshot Podcast. You can register via the link in the show notes and stay tuned for more details on that, but mark your calendars. Should be a fun few days at the Horse and Hunt Club in Prior Lake, Minnesota, Saturday, June 8th, the main event. All right, before we welcome our guest into the show today, I will just quickly say I hope some of you out there are hitting the turkey woods. Season opened up while I was down in Florida, and I have not been hunting yet, but I will be doing that very soon, likely next week, and I cannot wait. Probably have some turkey content coming up on the podcast in the near future. If you're heading out in pursuit of Old Tom, best of luck to you. It's another favorite time of year. And with that said, let's get on with the show. Welcome into the conversation and onto the Birdshot Podcast, Jim Gerchy.
I'm going to grit something to drink
and before we get.
We're going to pop the hose. Well, it's not a single malt.
Tuesday at 10. What is it? A soda water?
Oh, I got some limeade.
Ah, nice. Yeah, we turned our video off, so I don't know what you're drinking now, Gerch.
Yeah, it sounds good, though. That limeade works because I mix perfect margaritas with that.
Ah, what's the secret sauce, secret recipe?
Well, some fresh lime juice.
Okay, got to be fresh.
Limeade. I use the Jose Blue tequila and a little bit of simple syrup, just like a couple drops in there to sweeten it up.
And
you shake it
with
ice. It's really good.
Sounds tasty.
Yeah.
Probably something like that might taste pretty good this weekend when it's going to be, 70 degrees in your neck of the woods?
Definitely a summer drink.
Yeah. Yeah. It is becoming very spring-like, and we've got my buddy Gerch on the show with us today, and we're going to be talking, we'll talk a little bit of everything, I think, today, Gerch. Double guns, we got an upcoming event, bird dogs. What else do you get up to in the spring? I know you're a grouse guy at heart, but your interests are quite varied. So are you out fishing? Do you dabble in turkey hunting at all?
Yeah, I did the turkey thing. I in a couple of different states, a couple of different species, I don't know. I just kind of got over that a little bit. So I like spring fishing, crappies.
Yeah.
Carp fishing in the rivers this time of the year. Carp and sucker fishing is really fun.
Like with a bow or a spear, or how do you do that?
Well, I know just a light tackle, Okay. A little bit of a challenge.
What was it about the turkey hunting that wore off on you? Just kind of felt like you've been there, done that. 'Cause I feel like you would have good opportunities where you're located.
Yeah, lots of turkeys around. Of course, when I'm a little older than you, so
yeah.
I can remember when turkeys were reintroduced in Minnesota, and there wasn't a season. And since then, they've grown phenomenally. And of course, there's always that argument that turkeys are detrimental to grouse and woodcock.
Right. So,
I don't know about that, but Yeah, I'd been to Nebraska, Michigan, shot them with a bow, black powder. I mean, pretty much tried everything. And it's, don't get me wrong, it's a blast. That there's nothing more exciting than when you're calling that big Tom in and, you know, he's coming hard for the gobble and yeah. he gobbles back. And it's a great time to be in the woods too. You know, you can mushroom hunt and usually you're done by noon. So there's other things to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's, yeah, that kind of hits on sort of the high notes for me. And like you said, I think that's part of what has sort of caught my attention about it is, I mean, growing up here in northern Minnesota, we didn't really have, or at least, I mean, I don't ever remember seeing turkeys, flushing turkeys. I don't know exactly the timeline of their march to the north, but we definitely have them now, and it's a completely new opportunity within the last decade or so. So that's been, it's pretty interesting. I mean, it's, they're right where I would normally go grouse hunting. There's, now I'm seeing turkeys and turkey tracks, and it's not a, depending on where I go, it's not an abundance of them, but I imagine that will continue at this point.
Yeah, I think the populations of turkeys, like any other upland game bird, you know, it, they're dependent on a lot of things for their success, and what's good for the turkey might not be good for the grouse or the deer, or I don't know how all that works,
right?
But I know it's all related.
A lot of variables at play. Yeah. What about, well, you got a young setter. I want to talk about him a little bit. What about, do you get into the trialing or at least running on spring wild birds at all? Do you spend any time doing that?
I don't. I want to get him certified for woodcock banding, but he's not there yet. You know, he's, he literally turned a year March 1st.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay.
So, but I ran him last fall. I think, I don't know if you saw him or not, but God, he's just an awesome looking dog and he's got a great personality and he's a little bird finder. So I'm really excited to get him back into the woods this fall. And maybe next year he can graduate to woodcock banding. We'll see how steady he is. I mean, he's really good now. Like he's pretty trustworthy on his birds, but that banding thing's a whole different thing. They got to be rock solid.
So right.
It wouldn't take until he's ready.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, he's a male setter. And I remember when you came up to Pine Ridge a couple of years ago to do your gun fitting with Dell, I remember chatting with you at that time and you were kind of, I had Rose and you were kind of telling me, yeah, I like a nice small female setter for your grouse dogs. Now you wound up with a male setter, but why the setters for you?
I just like the way they handle their birds. You know, they're just a little more finesse on their grouse. And don't get me wrong. My first pointing dog was a German short hair and I took lots of grouse and woodcock over that dog. Yeah. I mean, they're more of a meat dog. I don't know if that's offensive to some people, but
maybe,
I mean, it is what it is. I mean, they're awesome to have on the ground when you got a winged bird down. I mean, you hardly ever lose a bird if you're hunting behind a short hair. You know, setters, they're a little more snooty than the continental breeds. And, you know, sometimes they retrieve, sometimes they don't,
quirky. I guess. Yeah.
But, I mean, they're just pretty in the woods. And I like the English setter because of the color. I mean, white just sticks out in the woods. They're easy to find when they're on point. Most of them are pretty biddable. They'll stay close and they handle nice. So just overall a good dog. And size wise, you know, I think the smallness and Gus is going to be on the smaller side for a male. And that was by design.
Yeah.
I just think they have a little bit more stamina and they go through the woods a little easier. That's really the only reason.
Yeah. That's kind of what caught my attention when we were chatting too, is just the size, because Rose was, you know, pretty significantly smaller than Hartley. So I was kind of seeing some difference, and Hartley's not a big dog. I mean, he's 50 pounds. That's pretty typical. Where's your dog at? He's in the 40s.
Yeah. He might make 40, you know, he's okay. Close. So we'll see. Okay. You never know until you know.
Yeah. And you hear different things, you know, bigger dog is maybe harder on himself getting through the cover, but then I hear that on the small side too. Like if the dog is too small, it's harder for them to get through the cover. But I would say, and I don't know how wide of a range I'm talking about here, but the difference between my two dogs, I mean, I don't see a whole lot of difference. Mainly, it seems like Rose can do anything that Hartley can do with her small size, which is 36, 37 pounds or so.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for what you're using them for, I don't think you're going to notice that much difference. Now, if you were...
Right.
If they were on a guide string and they were on the ground 3-4 times a day, then you're going to start to be able to tell the difference. Like, I got into the setter, I got to think back, this was quite a few years ago. One of my first guide dog setters was a smaller female, and I literally had the short hair and the setter, and that was my guide string. And I, you know, we'd hunt from 9 in the morning till, you know, 5 o'clock at night, and those two dogs never missed a beat. I mean, call it lucky or whatever, lots of miles. And, you know, once in a while they'd come up lame, but they were tough dogs and they hunted every day.
Were you pretty much always alternating them one dog at a time?
Yeah. You know, they would all, and it would depend, I guess, if I had two short covers and I knew that where the whole key to it is hunt the covers, you know, and then you kind of figure out where the birds are and you don't burn a lot of dog power looking for birds, you know. Now, you don't always have that luxury, right? Like you go to a new area and you just have to have that dog that can find birds. So that ends up being the one on the ground. And then the next time you go there, you just walk the shorter running dog into the spot you found the birds before. And that usually works out pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. How did you grow up in the St. Cloud area somewhere else? Like, I know you and your brothers are, you kind of been at the outdoor pursuits for a long, long time. How did it get started for you?
Yeah. So I grew up on the banks of the Mississippi River in a town called Sauk Rapids here in Minnesota.
Okay.
And, it was a small town when I was growing up. It's quite a bit bigger now, but I'd shoot my BB gun all around town back then, you know, because nobody cared. And there was a lot of woods along the river at that time. So, you know, I've seen grouse and deer right up close to the, you know, house. And
yeah,
but fish in the river, we'd come home from school and right down to the river, shorts and tennis shoes and a little ultralight rod and one of those small tackle packs, chuck full of beetle spins because they were 79 cents or whatever at the bait shop. You would just pound smallies and walleyes and whatever all day long.
Sounds like a fun way to grow up.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, and it taught you a lot about, you know, talk about trial and error. You sure learn fast, you know, how not to lose your beetle spin in the rocks, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So what about the bird hunting and the bird dogs? Because obviously you kind of alluded to it. You've done some guiding and you're on, you know, hunting behind pointing dogs and you're out of Pine Ridge and that sort of thing. But from the beginning, did you guys have bird dogs growing up, or was that something you kind of came to later?
Well, that's something I kind of came to later. Like my dad and my grandfather. My grandfather was from Wadena, grew up in Wadena, and ended up moving to Sauk Rapids and owned a small grocery store where that's kind of where our family got started in town here. But they were huge waterfowlers. So we would, on the weekends, we would go up to, we hunted Rush Lake by Perm for, you know, quite a few years because that's kind of was his backyard when he was growing up. And we shot ducks there, and then we'd also go out to Marsh Lake and, you know, on the western border past Graceville and Browns Valley and out that direction. Mud Lake, I guess, is out there. But so it was a lot of duck hunting. But I can remember my first grouse experience was, you know, you'd sit in the duck boat from 4 in the morning until 9 o'clock, and sometimes when the birds weren't flying, I'd get my waders on and walk to shore and strip those waders off and walk around in the woods stocking foot chasing grouse. So, I mean, that was, and I'd shoot at them mostly. Once in a while I'd get one, but I thought they were the greatest bird ever back then, you know.
Just captivated you.
Yeah. And so then my first bird dog was, I got an English setter. I don't even remember where I got this dog from, but it was a full-grown setter. And I built the kennel in our backyard. My parents were very forgiving about things like that. So I cobbled together this, a kennel setup. And I got this setter, and I didn't know the first thing about hunting with a pointing dog, right? So I took this dog down to, we were hunting just south of St. Augusta on a, it was our neighbor. He was the mailman, but he was into the hunting stuff too. So he dragged us kids around, and we brought that dog, and we were chasing grouse, pheasant, whatever there was there, right? And I can remember that dog went on point. There was snow on the ground. We were walking this slough edge. That dog stopped, and I'd never seen a dog point before and did not move. And I walked back there, and I couldn't figure out why that dog wasn't chasing them birds up, you know. And a big rooster busted out of this cattail, like, tent of snow and brown cattails. And I was so mesmerized, I never even fired a shot.
Sounds about right.
From then on, it was, you know, I figured, well, I better figure this out so I can use this dog. And I shot a few birds over that dog, but it wasn't very well mannered, and it was hard to keep in the kennel and all that stuff. So.
Yeah, that's cool though. So do you have two brothers?
I have three brothers. So
three. Okay. I think I know I met at least one. I don't know if there was three of you guys there when we were shooting that one day, but you guys are all big shotgun shooters.
Yeah, we all, and it was always a competition, you know, who shoot the most ducks and, you know, who shot the other guy's limit or whatever. I mean, it was just, and the other thing we did, I guess I never mentioned this, but, my grandfather was the state crow shooting champ back in the 40s, right? They used to have a contest.
No kidding.
Where you'd mail the feed into the state and they'd tally them up. And he actually won the championship one year. We used to, in this, and he was the president of the St. Cloud, Anglers Club or something. And then they started the Sauk Rapids Sportsman's Club, and my grandpa ended up being president of that thing for like 37 years or something.
Jeez.
And part of my grandpa's projects was building wood duck houses. So they would build hundreds of wood duck boxes. And then my grandpa and my brothers would drive up, pick up my grandpa's brother in Wadena, and we would go on, I don't know, like just a milk run of wood duck boxes that we had put up on trees. And I think at one time we had 200 of them or something up in that area, right? So in the springtime, you would have to go up there, put a bag of sawdust in there and close the bottom up. And then in the fall, you open them up and let the sawdust come out so the squirrels couldn't nest in there in the spring, right? So then it would be accessible to the wood ducks when they came back in April or whatever.
Yeah.
So part of go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, I remember hearing about wood duck boxes more when I was younger, and I just like, it's not nothing I've looked into or anything, but is that like less of a thing now? People putting up wood duck boxes?
I guess I've seen a lot of them around. There's, you know, there's plastic ones you can buy now. So I think you can just order them from Amazon. So I don't know how much of it gets built or whatever, but I've seen a fair number of them around.
Yeah. I know there's one, there's an old sort of dilapidated one by the right above a beaver swamp where I run my dogs every day. And I always just kind of, I don't think it's in use and it's not being taken care of, but I just see it and think of it every time I walk by.
Well, that's pretty cool, but they're a lot of work. I mean, if you open them in the spring and fall, and we had these like along the Leaf River and every little pothole and slough, but we would drive in and he had a station wagon. So we would tie this aluminum extension ladder onto the top of the car and we would have all the other stuff in the back end of that station wagon, and we would lug that ladder and a bag of sawdust or however many bags we needed to do that little short run, whatever was on that little slough. We drag that ladder through the woods. I guess that's how I learned to go through the woods so good. And close them up or open them up or whatever. But in the springtime, the trade-off was we got to bring the crow caller along. And in the afternoon, once we got most of the wood duck boxes done, we could crow hunt for the rest of the day. So I don't know if you've ever done that with a crow caller.
You know what? I one day I went with some high school. I was probably in maybe college or high school. A buddy of mine, it was kind of this, it was like in the spring, like you're talking about. And my buddy's like, do you want to go crow hunting? And I'm thinking, yeah, you know, I love to go hunting, and it's springtime. So if hunting season's over, and we went out, I remember, I don't even know if we had a decoy. We sat like near a dump or like a garbage pit or something for like an hour. And let's just say there wasn't a whole lot of crow activity, but that's my only exposure.
Yeah. So, I mean, back then we had the old herders. It was a actual record player with a 45 record and a speaker. And I think 2 6-volt lantern batteries. I don't even know if you know what those are or look like, but we would turn that thing on, and it would be the best record was the crows fighting an owl, and you would put that on, and it would be a recording of crows fighting an owl, you know?
Is there like a heavy metal bass track to that?
Yeah. You know, the owl hoots once in a while, but it's a natural thing. And these crows hate owls, great horned owls, because I guess at night the owl comes in there and picks these crows out their roost. Hmm. And so if you play that and those crows can hear it, they will come looking for a fight, right? So what you do is you set that speaker up and then you get downwind of it. And those crows will always come in, you know, from wherever they are until they get downwind of that speaker, and they will turn and go right back into it, right? Well, I figured that out before my brothers figured that out. So I would always place myself and downwind. And they used to get so mad because I'd do all the shooting, right? And then finally they figured it out. So then it was a race to see who could get to the best spot or whatever. But we, you know what? It was all fun. And we just did a lot of cool things. So,
yeah, that's what got me thinking about that. Was I was thinking your parents were probably used to you guys doing stuff like building a dog kennel and coming home with some full grown English setter.
Yeah, they were fairly tolerant of a lot of that stuff. So,
yeah. So then you eventually got into guiding. You guided for Steve Grossman, right?
Yeah. So there was, I met Steve Grossman at, you know, there's Game Fair in Minnesota now every fall. It's been going on for a long time, but there was another little show that a couple guys were going to start, and Grossman was at that. And I got invited to that because back when I published my newspaper, Outdoors Weekly, I went to all those shows. Right. And, so I met Grossman there, and believe it or not, I was doing a radio show at the local radio station. I had, I think I was on 3 days a week on their AM station and twice a week on their FM station. And the FM was 98 country. So it was a huge reach, right? So it was great exposure, and we had lots of fun. I had lots of guests on there, but I had Grossman, and I had a DAT recorder. And I was interviewing Grossman about bird dogs and grouse hunting and stuff like that. And he asked me, hey, you want to guide grouse hunters this fall? I'm like, well, never done it before, you know, but yeah, I'll try it out. So we made arrangements for that. And I guided my first grouse hunt this fall, but Grossman had set me up with this tiny little female setter. Her name was, they called her Sheba, I think. And then I renamed her to Kate because I like the word, I like Kate better than Sheba. So
one syllable.
And she was, she was a tough little setter, and I mean, found birds for you, and it didn't retrieve, but pointed dead, which is kind of what I prefer anyway. But
yeah,
That was kind of the start of it.
Where, so at that time, like how much were you like, did you have your short hair at the time? Like, I mean, how much were you grouse hunting it? And when he asked you to do that?
Yeah. So then, I had a short hair at the time, but I only use it for pretty much duck hunting and pheasant hunting. Okay. Right. So the first woodcock I ever shot was down in Sherburn Wildlife Refuge. I went in there looking for pheasants. And the dog and that short hair pointed that woodcock and it flew up. And I thought, God, that looks like a woodcock, you know? So I shot it hoping it wasn't a snipe, you know? And it was a woodcock, but the dog wouldn't pick it up. So I don't know if that was, you know, I don't know what that was all about. But anyway, so I shot a few birds with that short hair and guided that short hair a few times. But Steve had these clients from out east and they were, I don't know, you know, the snobby grouse hunter type thing, right? Well, these guys wanted to shoot grouse over English setters and pointed and, you know, well-managed dogs and all that kind of thing. Yeah. So I ended up trading that short hair to Steve for another setter. So I had two setters and that was my strength. So.
Yeah. Well, I imagine you learned a thing or two running with Grossman over the years.
Oh my God. Steve taught me so much. Like, I mean, I guess the most thing was what to expect out of your dog, you know, and how to get him to that point. And the biggest thing is, I mean, it's really pretty easy. I said, you have to demand excellence at all times if you want him at that level.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that's kind of what I did. And I mean, I've had some hellacious bird dogs over the years. I mean, I've been so lucky. Just amazing. In fact, so then I was doing my newspaper at the time, right? So I could kind of work remotely back then, but I, you know, had a pretty good system going. So one October, I hunted 30 days.
Guided almost 30 got days. Them all.
Almost got them all.
A buddy of mine, Ted, he has this. I mean, he's come close. Not that close, I don't think, but he always has, at least in the back of his mind, he wants to hunt every day in October. And it's an idea that I can buy into for sure. I haven't got it yet.
Not just hunt every day. That would be kind of easy, actually. But you guide every day. That means your dogs run for 30 days straight. That means, you know, you got to deal with clients every day for 30 days. I mean,
that's a grind.
Yeah, that is a grind.
So let's sort of bring this back around to your 1 year old setter, because the point I was kind of getting at is that you've been doing this for a long time. You used to guide for Grossman, and you do some guide for Jerry at Pine Ridge, and you've seen lots of bird dogs over the years. And how do you? And I'll be real curious to get your thoughts as far as, like, you know, a fall like we had last year with a young dog. Obviously there was lots of birds out there for the dog to get into. So kind of what you saw in his development, but how do you go about it? I mean, in a year like last year, is it just, I mean, there's enough birds out there. Like, I just need to get this dog into birds.
Yeah. So I think with a young dog, and like, so I'm not a dog trainer, but I know what I like in a dog.
Yeah.
And I know what I want them to do. And that's what I try to get them to do. Right. Now, how you get there sometimes is the hard part. Right. So, what I usually do with a young dog, like, I've only had maybe one or two other dogs that have, you know, from this age on. I usually will get set up with a started dog.
Okay.
And then polish it the way I want it. To me, that's the most efficient way to do things. You don't have to worry about the gun intro and all that stuff. So I got Gus from a guy down in Georgia because I liked the breeding on it. And I've seen a couple of his brothers from a past litter. So they did a repeat breeding and I took, you know, one of the pups. So I ended up with Gus. So going into last fall, I mean, I don't think I've ever seen as many birds in a single season as I had last fall, honestly.
Really?
I mean, you talk about back in the in the glory days, like in the Grossman days, we were maybe moving 40 birds a day. I mean, that was a pretty good day back then. Grouse, I'm talking.
Yeah.
Woodcock, I mean, you could get as many woodcock as you wanted, you know, as much time as you wanted to spend on chasing woodcock, that's how many you'd get. But so if you did wood, if you chase grouse and then just took your woodcock, you'd probably get 20 woodcock flushes and 40 grouse flushes a day. That was a pretty good day.
Yep.
So when I got Gus, he was, well, he turned a year in March. So whatever he was in October, I was a little nervous about putting him on the ground in front of clients. Like I never did it. Actually, I did it once or twice, but because I wanted the situation to be controlled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when you have someone that you don't really know, you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Right. So, I would get the clients all put back, and I don't guide a lot anymore. And Jerry knows that, but he tries to get me to guide more every year. Right. But I keep telling him there's only so many miles left in these legs and I'm going to use them for meat. Right. So I would get the clients put back and then I would take the dog out and do my thing with the dog. And so what I think the best thing you can do with a young dog at that age, you know, 7 months maybe,
yeah,
is just get him in the birds and let him make mistakes.
Yeah.
But you can't shoot birds that he's made a mistake on. Because that'll short circuit everything you've worked for, right?
Yeah.
So you got to be fairly disciplined when you have a young dog, and unfortunately, the more birds there are, the more mistakes you can let them make, right? Right.
Yeah.
Gearing up for your next hunt? Check out Ugly Dog Hunting Company for all your dog supply needs. Ugly Dog Hunting carries a full line of products for your bird dog and even some for you. Whether you're looking for dog collars, GPS tracking devices, kennels, beds, leads, training equipment, or first aid supplies, Ugly Dog Hunting carries it and a whole lot more. New owner of the company and friend of the Birdshot podcast, Mike Nadusky, loves to remind me that while I do hunt with pretty dogs, every dog can be an ugly dog. Check out the entire selection of gear for you and your bird dog at uglydoghunting.com. For many upland hunters, along with their passion for dogs, birds, and the places we chase them, comes a passion for shotguns. Upland Gun Company specializes in customizing shotguns for the upland bird hunter, imported from Italy and shipped direct to an FFL near you. Select from one of their side-by-side or over-under shotgun platforms and customize the fit, function, and aesthetics to your liking. Design and build your next upland hunting shotgun with Upland Gun Company today. Visit uplandguncompany.com.
Yeah, you can go find the next one. It takes some of that pressure. I mean, again, I think you're at a point where my assumption is that you're not so eager to take a shot at a grouse. I mean, you can. I'm guessing you can really take your foot off the gas and just watch the dog work and wait for the right opportunity. Whereas, you know, me 10 years ago, you got your first dog. It's a little bit different. I felt more pressure to like, oh, I want to, you know, connect the dots. And that changed a lot even for me with the second dog. But how do you define a mistake when you're watching a young dog? Is it, you know, just getting too close to a bird, obviously running straight at one?
So I think, you know, with a dog, the reward becomes the shot. Right. If they do everything right, handle their bird right, the hunter does what they're supposed to do, and that bird flushes, you get the shot. And then some of the times you get the bird on the ground, which is the real reward. Yeah. And I think the reward becomes the shot because the bird hitting the ground doesn't happen until the shot. Right. So, common mistakes, crowding the bird, not being steady on point, figuring out. You know, some dogs know how to work the cover and some dogs just run through the woods.
Yeah.
You know? Well, there's a difference. There's a real difference. And I think they start to learn what covers may potentially hold birds better than others. They get better at going through the woods. How to use the wind, you know, they're always checking the wind to see how they're going to check out that piece or I guess... you know, you can tell, and I always have to run a bell on a young dog because if you can't see them, you don't know what they're doing.
The feedback.
You don't know what mistake they just made. So yep. I mean, I think that's pretty important.
So will you then, you said younger dog, do you not necessarily run a bell on an older dog or do you always run a bell in the grouse woods?
I'm not going to say always, but most of the time I do. Yeah. Okay. The only time I didn't run a bell last fall was when one of the Gordons pointed a timber wolf because I didn't have a bell.
Oh, boy.
So, I mean, pretty much ran a bell after that.
Yeah. But how did that play out? I don't know. I don't know if I heard that story.
So I got a little cover, maybe, I don't know, it's 5 miles from camp there. Right. So it was one of those times where you're coming back to camp and it's like, hey, you want to hit one more little cover, take half hour, you know? Yeah, sure. So I know the lay of the land there, so I know how to get in and out fairly easy. So I'm like, and I've been hunting one of Stevens Gordons for some of the fall, right? Because I don't want to have this pup on
Stephen Faust, so that is.
Yeah, Stephen Faust. Yep. So he's kind enough to let me put some finishing touches on some of his Gordons, which...
Well, you got to clean up a few of his mistakes, right?
Sure, right?
Just kidding, Steven.
So I had one of them on the ground and I had been running them for a while. So, you know, they're very trustworthy and just they handle so nice. And so I'm like, I kind of want to run silent here because I don't want to... Don't want these birds to know, you know, what's going on. Sometimes it's better if you surprise them than if they can hear that coming, you know. So I ran that Gordon without the bell, but I do have a GPS collar on him, right?
Yeah.
So I couldn't see him anymore, and I knew he stopped. I couldn't hear him going, so I located him, and he was maybe 100 yards out, maybe 75. That's a long ways in the woods, you know. So I got the hunter's attention and we walked that direction. And those, like I said, the black dogs are harder to find, right? So you got to do a little more searching for them. So I found the dog and he was standing steady. It was a pretty open spot. Thinking, this doesn't look, you know, bird-like, but, you know, you always have to trust the dog. So
right,
walked up in front of the dog, looked around, and I just had a funny feeling, right? The dog wasn't moving. And I looked kind of off to my left and about 25 yards away was this big, dark haired, almost black timber wolf just sitting on his haunches.
Really? Just sitting down.
Yep. And they were just looking at each other.
Wow.
So I stepped in between the dog and the wolf. And by that time, the wolf took off, just spun around and was gone. Like literally didn't make a sound and was gone.
Yeah.
So I figured I better run a bell off from now on.
Jeez, that's wild. That's I always, anytime I hear something like that, it's strangely comforting to know that you can come that close to a timber wolf and not have it end in a worst case scenario, right? It's because you know you're in wolf country anywhere we're hunting, and obviously I did the interview last September where we talked to a bunch of few different people that had timber wolf encounters, and the bell thing is one thing that I think about. But yeah, that's obviously nothing bad happened. That's a good thing, but that's a tense moment, I'd imagine.
Yeah, but I mean, it could have been different too. Like if I wasn't there, let's say that dog was 300 yards and lost.
Right, you know? Right.
Things went way different.
How far do you think the dog, how far was the dog away from you when the point occurred?
Probably 75.
75, so you're over there relatively quickly, yep.
Pretty light cover, so I mean, maybe it was 30 seconds, you know, or so, but.
Yep.
I mean, that dog, who knows what that wolf would have done. I mean, and they're fine because I'm sure you encounter more wolves than you ever know.
Yes.
I mean, they see you and you don't see them.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. You've got to be within their presence, you know, more than you know is what I would imagine. But Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't heard that story, but yeah, that is one reason. Who was I talking to? It was just recently somebody was, I think I was looking at something on Instagram actually, where a guy was talking about bells and, he likes to wear them just to not come up. He was out west and, encountered like a bear or something, you know, just again, it's that awareness thing. And I know you hear different things regarding the bells, but I think all things considered, it's best to kind of make your presence known.
It sure is. And I mean, you're in that wolf's backyard, you know, that's his domain, not yours. You're kind of visiting. So,
yeah.
I mean, if you can make yourself, if he's aware of you, that's fine. You guys can coexist. As long as he doesn't eat grouse.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Man, have you had any other sort of strange encounters over the years, is like moose, bear, anything like that with dogs and hunting?
One time I had a client, a Grossman's kid from Virginia. He's a attorney and nice family. The Words, Tom Word actually was his dad, and he wrote some books. I don't recall the names of them, but a lot of field trial and stuff. He did a lot of coverage for what was that publication that the field trialers all? It slips my mind right now.
Is it like not like Field Dog Stud Book or something?
Not the stud book, the one that they actually cover the field trials.
Yeah, I feel like that is sort of on the tip of my tongue, but I don't know.
Yeah, I can't remember. Anyway, so he did a lot of that kind of stuff, and they had setters, and they would come out every year, you know. So got to know them pretty good. So Scott and I were walking this cover, and we had to walk in this flooded road. So we kind of had, it was ankle deep. We didn't want to drive it and get stuck. So we walked in and walked down along the edge of that swamp, and the wind had blown like it always does there and knocked some of them trees over. So there was some big root balls sticking up, and the dog was in there rooting around, and we kind of followed in, and we got in there maybe 10 yards, and I bet Scott and I were probably maybe 20 yards apart, probably closer, and a black bear ran right between us, come out from under one of the nook balls, and went right between us. Scott just, I mean, if you could have seen his face,
it's a tense moment.
Totally shocked, right? Yeah. And I'm like, what are you scared for? You're the one holding the shotgun, right? So we kept hunting, and I think we maybe killed a couple birds in there. I think we called that cover the old windmill, because there was an old windmill back in the middle of this woods, and it was like kind of out of place. But so we came back out, and we were sitting on that road having lunch, and he had his back to where that bear had run out, and I was sitting on the tailgate, and he was in one of my chairs, and we were eating lunch, and I made like I was looking down that road like someone was coming up behind him. He came flying out of that chair.
Jump out of the chair.
So he was still a little nervous about that bear encounter.
He was on edge.
Let's see what else. I mean,
of course, you didn't miss an opportunity to take advantage of it.
Of course not. God, just, I mean, I was in a cover one time with, that was Joe Toot. So this guy was the American 410 skeet shooting champion. And, he was really a pretty good shot, and he had some really nice shotguns. He had a Holland and Holland side by side, I think he was shooting that day. And we were back in this woods, and it was a nice cover. There was scattered red pine, some aspen, and then every once in a while there would be a patch of dogwood, maybe, you know, 20 yards across inside this, and it was this perfect grouse cover. So we were back in there, and we flushed a grouse. And I think we flushed two, and he shot one, and the other one flew off, and I heard it like wings flapping or whatever. So I'm like, God, did you shoot at that one? He said, no, I had to finish this one. So I said, well, let's follow it up. So we followed up, and that grouse had flown into a branch and impaled itself.
No way.
On a broken aspen branch. And snapped that branch off and was laying on the ground flopping around.
Wow. I've heard of them. I've heard of them flying into trees and stuff. I don't think I've ever seen it happen, but actually impaled.
God, another time, speaking of flying into stuff, Kevin Shepard, Shep and I were.
I was going to ask, yeah.
Yeah, we were hunting on, it was, so we hunt county, this county, so this was more towards.
Don't get too descriptive here. Jerry and Shep are going
to
get
it. Yeah, right. You'll have to beep that out.
Yeah, I will.
And we were chasing these grouse, and one flew up, and I mean, it come out of this side corner. It was pretty wild. I don't know why, though. I think it was kind of windy. But you know how they just get going like 40 miles an hour, mm-hmm. and then it was banking around this corner. And Shep was up on the ridge walking, and there was this little corner fence row. It was kind of open where we flushed that bird, but there was a corner, and it was posted, no trespassing, right? And there was this trailer house just set back in there, right? And this bird comes whipping around the corner, and it curves in, and it flew right into that trailer house. So Shep went in there and picked it up and claimed it as his own.
Smack dab in the middle of the double wide.
Yeah, hit the double wide in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it could have flown literally any direction.
That's crazy.
God, there was a time I had this setter called Autumn. She was a decent little setter. I didn't really trust her on point, right? She was not trustworthy, but pretty steady at times. I had these two clients, and we were hunting a chunk of private that I knew this guy. This was not funny, but and then it's Jack Pine and Hazel, right? Okay. You know how that's just rugged stuff, right?
Yep.
And this stuff is thick. So we beat around in that for a while, and these guys shot at a few woodcock, and I don't even know if we shot at a grouse in there. Sometimes you don't get shots. You know how that goes. And so we sat down and had lunch under these big, tall white pines, one little stand.
Beautiful.
And the sun was shining, the wind was blowing. So it was just, you know, just perfect. Yeah. And so these guys are all wore out till the morning. They're like, hey, we're going to take a nap. Is that okay? I'm like, sure. Do you mind if I take the dog up and go run around this little bowl of alders, right? It was maybe 100 yards long and 50 yards wide. Wanted to shoot my woodcock and work on that dog, you know? So I put this, they're like, nope, go ahead. So they tuck in for their little sleep there in those folding chairs. And I throw the dog down and walk around, and I go around that little alder thing, and I shoot three woodcock, right now.
Bang, bang, bang.
So I got my limb of the woodcock. And Autumn's doing really good, and so I'm coming back. I take the shortcut. She makes a cast, goes out past this really thick aspen edge, goes in there, and, of course, goes on point, right? So I already got my three birds, so I'm kind of walk up to the edge. And where I'm standing, it's, like, underneath these big trees, so it's pretty wide open. There's green grass. So I'm trying to whistle that dog off point, right, get her to go.
Yeah.
And it takes about 2 or 3 minutes, and she finally breaks. And when she breaks, she flushes this woodcock. That woodcock flushes straight up, gets right about at the alder's top, and this goshawk swoops down and smashes that woodcock and lands about 10 feet in front of me, right? Now what do they call it? The candling when they guard their ray on the ground.
Yeah, yeah.
There's some forms for it. So the hawk's now looking at me guarding this woodcock on the ground, and here comes Autumn out of the alders, and she goes on point because that's
just looking at the hawk.
Hawk is sitting there. So it's me, the hawk, and Autumn, and I got my woodcock limit.
There's a training scenario for you.
So I'm like, well, the best thing is if I make that hawk fly and grab the dog, right? So it doesn't get ugly. So I move forward. The hawk flushes off the woodcock. Autumn breaks, fetches the woodcock, and brings it right to my hand. So now I'm standing there with three woodcock in my pouch and one in my hand. And thinking, how am I going to explain this to the game warden? You know, he's really going to believe that a hawk dropped that for me. I mean, there's a million stories, but the more time you can spend in the grouse woods, the better it is.
Truer words have never been spoken, my friend. Yep, that's for sure. God, there was something I was going to ask you. Maybe I'll think of it. But let's talk about the never mind. Grouse cover. I knew I had to ask you that because I've talked to Shep before, and I know you guys have hunted together, and you kind of were getting at it a little bit there. You mentioned jack pine. Do you hunt a lot of jack pine, or is that sort of a byproduct, or how do you think about that?
Well, sometimes you got to go where the birds are, right? So if you hunt in a certain area and that's what there is and that's what the birds are using, I mean, that's what you got to go in. I don't like that thick hazel underbrush. It's so abrasive on dogs and it's tough on your equipment. And I mean, the birds love it for obvious reasons. You know, they can hide in there, but even woodcock will use those jack pine.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's kind of lighter hazel, but I found them in jack pine sand. I mean, basically, figure out what hunting area you're going to be in and just, you know, figure out where the birds are there and then try to find that same cover. Just duplicate it. Usually works.
The jack pine it's funny because I feel like it doesn't come up a lot when people are talking about grouse cover. And I used to hunt more of it and I found it by accident, you know, just didn't know what I was doing back in high school and we're dogless and just walking trails and stuff. But we eventually recognized a pattern of grouse liking it's jack pine. And usually you got, you know, it's typically sandier soil. You got clover growing there and the grouse, I mean, they'll run around in there all day long eating clover leaves and it's obviously good cover. Good cover from avian predators and stuff. And so we used to walk through that stuff all the time and do pretty well. And in my adult life with the dogs and stuff, I don't typically go into that stuff because you're either going to have you might get a wide open shot for a second, or they're going to disappear behind the green wall. It's either kind of open or not. But it can be real tough to flush a bird with get a dog.
Because most of the jack pine you find nowadays are in a plantation, right?
Yes.
So you've got your gut and rolls. I mean, and like you said, you can see them for a second, or a lot of times you don't even see them because they're really good about putting stuff between you. So.
Yeah. And they'll run around underneath there and you know, it's the dogs can see them underneath, which you know, can make a dog come unglued, or it can be a good sort of exercise for a dog to sort of test it. But this year, I kind of stumbled upon a new spot. I was looking at some on my maps. I noticed some aspen cuts that I wanted to get to. And the easiest way to get to it was to walk along this gated ATV path that went through a big stand of jack pine. And I got into that jack pine and very quickly realized it just had some patches of aspen. It had all the clover and raspberry. And I was like, right away, like my gun came, I was like, there's going to be some birds in here. And sure enough, there was. And I moved a couple birds in there and they basically gave us the slip, kind of like what we're talking about. I had rows on the ground and I quickly left the jack pine and went in and to the aspen and had a pretty good hunt in there. But about a month later in the season, it was a really nice day in November, I think, I went back there with my son, my 5-year-old son, because it was such a nice gravel trail where he could cruise his bike along. And we just went right down that jack pine and I brought Hartley and we moved a bunch of birds in like not that long. And it just kind of, it brought me back. We had a really cool hunt in the jack pine. So
Yeah, that jack pine's good thermal cover, right? So late season, perfect for them.
Yeah, that's fun stuff. But yeah, so you're really, you're not too picky. You're just kind of, you're trying to figure out where the birds are and find more of that stuff. Obviously, you know, you're paying attention to aspen and, you know, the food sources and stuff. Is there anything that you, do you really like to be on a swamp edge? Like, is there any sort of components of a grouse cover that you really like to have there?
I think edges is important. Not, you know, not anything in particular. You have to have edges. You need a food source, obviously. In the dry year, water is huge. I mean, most of the time there's water all over in the woods, but if you get a dry season, there's literally, they have to be where the water is.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just kind of how it is for them. But when I, so when I grouse hunt, I'm not like, and like, I just like to go, like I'm an explorer when I'm a grouse hunter, right? So I just go for a walk and I'll stop and look at the beaver cuttings. I'll look at, you know, if there's a tree tipped over and there's something digging under it, I'll, you know, I check things out. I like to look at things. So, you know, I guess that's why I like grouse hunting. And then if you get a bird flush in between all that sightseeing, even better.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I think, and that's, you know, maybe one, you got the pointing dog where you don't have to be totally intent on what the dog is doing. You can kind of let your mind wander and observe things. I mean, I certainly enjoy that aspect of it too.
Yeah. When you get to that point with your dog, you know, you have a grouse dog. If you don't have to constantly worry about where they are or what they're doing, you just either waiting for that bell to stop or waiting for that vibrate on your Garmin watch or whatever you're using.
So when it comes to Gus this off season leading up to next year, will you be doing much with him, or are you basically just going to be keeping him in shape and getting ready for next fall?
I'm gonna try to steady him up on some birds, but I don't even like to use pigeons, you know, and traps and that sort of thing. But I'll take the time for early season next fall. Like, I'll get out before the cover's really prime for grouse, and then you can't see to shoot anyway, so it's not as tempting. Right. But I'll set the gun down and make the dog stand how I want him to stand and all that sort of thing. But I mean, you can't go through the summer without working on it a little bit.
Yeah. Awesome, buddy. Well, let's transition a little bit. We'll talk about the upcoming event that you've been working on for the team at Upland Gun Company, and give listeners a little sneak peek of what's to come, and if anybody is in the area or wanting to travel to Minnesota in June, there might be some fun and festivities they could attend.
Yeah, it's going to be an awesome event. I mean, so what it is, it's going to be called the Midwest Double Gun Classic, and it's at the Horse and Hunt Club in Prior Lake, Minnesota.
Just south of Minneapolis, essentially.
Yeah, just far enough from Minneapolis to where you don't have to drive too far, but yet you're out of the city. So June 7th and 8th is going to be the 8th will be the competition day, and the 7th will be the practice day for the shooters. But we're going to have some Upland Gun Company partners there. Onyx, Ukanuba, Final Rise, you know, you can name them off, but they're going to be there, and they're going to be there to talk to people that want to learn about their products. So if you're into shooting and grouse hunting and want to get into it more and learn more, this would be a good chance to do it. It's free. There's no charge to get there. If you want to compete, you know, you'll have to pay for your targets, but even if you don't want to compete, we're going to have shooting games so that you can do the grouse walk or the pheasant flush or the duck flurry, or I don't know exactly what it's going to be yet, but there's going to be all kinds of things to do. Now, of course, we're going to encourage you to shoot a double gun, preferably a side-by-side, but you don't have to for the shooting games. There's going to be events for every kind of gun, and we're going to do a ladies division and a youth division too. So there'll be prizes and trophies.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. So June 7th is a Friday. Saturday the 8th is the competition day.
Correct.
Okay. And we will, so last year, and I can fill in here, last year Upland Gun Company, we did a fitting event at the Horse and Hunt Club. And just anybody who's ever been there, great facility, good location. They've got multiple sporting clay courses. I mean, they're just really well set up there. They've got the bar, the kind of the outdoor gazebo area where they do live music and stuff. I mean, it's just a perfect venue for hosting something like this. So naturally, Jerry and the folks at Horse and Hunt, Nikki and everybody down there kind of collaborated and put our heads together, and we've sort of been building up to this, and then you kind of took the lead on it, Gertch, and we're coming right up on it. By the time listeners hear this, I mean, the event will be coming up pretty quick. So this will be the first mention of it on the podcast, and registration for that open, or that competition shoot, is it's open now. So the links and everything will be in the show notes. But like you said, if you're not wanting to shoot in the official event, there you're more than welcome, and we encourage folks to come on down, check out the stuff from Up and Gun Company and the other vendors that you mentioned. There will be live music on Friday night, maybe some other festivities on Saturday night. Some of those details are still coming together, but all in all, it's a great venue, great facility, and it'll be a pretty cool gathering of double gun enthusiasts.
Yeah, and if you're a serious sporting clay shooter, you can go on Score Chaser and register for this shoot.
Yeah,
you can pay right online, so you can get signed up right now.
Awesome.
And it's limited. It's going to be limited to like a few hundred shooters. So, I mean, it's going to be an exclusive place.
So in the event that somebody listening to this, they go and try to register, that's full. Again, that goes back to if that shoot is full, you're still welcome to come on down, and there'll be other stuff there for folks to do as well.
Yeah, I'd say if the online one is full and you just come on down, more than likely someone won't show up. You can take that spot.
Okay. Cool, man. Well, anything else folks need to know? They can register in advance for that shoot. Otherwise, we will, Upland Gun Company and the others you mentioned, will be at the Horse and Hunt Club June 7th, 8th, and like the 9th Sunday is kind of leave day. But we'll be there all week really doing gun fittings and stuff ahead of the show. So then that Friday, Saturday is the official Midwest Double Gun Classic.
Yeah, what's amazing to me is that you guys are going to do fittings all week, and I think you're almost full up.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, you were with us at Pheasant Fest in Sioux Falls, and we knew we had that event coming up, so we took lots of, there was a lot of interest there, and usually as quick as we can plan those fitting events, they tend to get filled up with customers have guns in the pipeline and are ready to go. So
if I knew how important fitting was to shooting well, I would have done it, you know, a long time ago.
Yeah. Well, your favorite grouse gun is a 14 gauge now these days?
Oh, wow. Not quite, because that's only a single barrel.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
But I do have that. I shot Gus's first pointed bird was a woodcock, and I shot it with that 14.
Did you really?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Do you have to load those by hand?
Yeah, so the backstory is when I was running the deer lodge up at Autumn Antlers, we had this gun on the wall, and it's just an old wall hanger, right? But I liked it because it was an old single shot. Doesn't have a fore end on it, so I thought maybe that was missing, right? So after they closed the lodge and sold that off, and I acquired that shotgun, so I took it down to the gunsmith, and I said, God, would you measure the bore on this thing? I don't know what it is. And they measured it, and he said it was a 14 gauge, right? So I'm like, oh, that's cool. So then I started looking up, you know, started Googling the markings on this gun, and it comes up as a J. Stevens tip-up shotgun, right? Not a lot of info on it, but I think it's like 1875 is the patent date on it. So So I start looking around for 14 gauge low pressure shells, right? Because I don't know if I want to shoot high pressure in a,
right,
you know, 150 year old shotgun, right? So couldn't find anything. So I ended up going to, I ordered online from a place in Wyoming these brass, they actually turn these brass cartridges. So I got 10 of those, went down to Ballistic Products and got some number 7 nickel shot, got some powder, and the place that makes the cartridges actually sends you a little loading block.
Okay.
So you can hand load these cartridges. Yeah, yeah. So I loaded up a few of them and dragged that out. So my goal this year is going to be to shoot a grouse with that.
Nice. So it's a brass case. I remember you showed them to me. It's a brass case. What do you put a, like a felt, like a card over the top, or how do you close it on top?
Yeah. So basically, you know, it's just a regular shotgun primer. You put your powder in there, carefully measured, right?
Yeah. And, yeah.
And you just snap felt wads in there.
Okay.
Pull your shot in, and then you put a cap over the top of it, just another paper cap. And then the trick is you put some rubber cement. There's this, I can't remember the brand of it, but you put rubber cement around the top and it seals it. So it all stays together until you shoot it.
So you can carry them around in your pocket or whatever.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Does the gun fit you?
It's not too bad. It's a little weird because you're just holding the barrel, you know.
Right. Right.
And the trigger guard has got a little pinky slot where your pinky slides in. So it's kind of dainty. It's got a hammer on it. It's fun to shoot.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a neat one. Yeah. I know you're, you had a Zeus 28 and we're working on another one for you. 2832, right?
Yeah. So I can't wait to get that. That hopefully that'll be here in time for the shoot.
Yes, that's the preview of the Midwest Double Gun Classic presented by Upland Gun Company again at Horse and Hunt Club in Prior Lake, Minnesota. So Gertch and I hope to see you there. Buddy, I appreciate it. It was fun to catch up as always, and I know I'm looking forward to spending some time with you at the Horse and Hunt Club.
Yeah, thanks, Nick.
All right, that does it for this episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Hang on with me for just a second, Gertch. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and share. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Onyx Hunt is the number one hunting GPS app. Join millions of other hunters who trust Onyx Hunt to find more game, discover new access, and hunt smarter. Onyx Hunt shows you nationwide public and private land boundaries. They've got topographic and 3D maps. You can track your route, location, and elevation profile. You can save maps for offline use and take Onyx Hunt with you wherever you go. The most comprehensive hunting tool you'll own. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and use the promo code BSP20 to save 20% on your next Onyx Hunt subscription. Know where you stand with Onyx.
Hey everyone, this is Nick from the Gun Dog It Yourself podcast. If you enjoyed this show, then you might want to check out my show as well. We highlight and break down the ins and outs of training your own hunting dog. Whether it's a bird dog or even the occasional hound dog episode, we cover all topics related to hunting dogs. Check out Gun Dog It Yourself on any podcast streaming platform and hit the subscribe button to be sure not to miss any future episodes.